Good evening and welcome to Outsources, a weekly KGNU program that provides you with content by and for queer communities in Colorado. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and tonight I'm speaking with Morgan Klaus Scheuermann, a doctoral student at the University of Colorado at Boulder, whose research focuses on how artificial intelligence and machine learning are connected to issues of social identity and discrimination. This past year, Morgan was one of 10 students selected nationally for a Microsoft PhD research fellowship, and his work has been featured in news outlets like The Scientific American and CNN. Morgan, thank you so much for joining me on Outsources.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I want to get into your research more. I'm really excited about digging into that. But before we dive into that, I guess I'm wondering about the kind of windy road that led you to where you are now doing the kind of research you are, you know, here in Colorado at CU Boulder. Was technology, things like machine learning, artificial intelligence, AI, were these things you were always interested in or drawn to? Or what was it like kind of approaching those topics for research?
Yeah, I was absolutely not interested or drawn to this. So when I first started my college career, which was a very long, winding path for me, I was in photography, actually. So I have an associate's in photography, and I really wanted to go and do photography for a living. I was really interested in doing particularly like fashion photography. So that's what I saw myself doing, and that didn't pan out that well. Instead of going, I was going to go to like New York, the School of Visual Arts for my bachelor's, but it was just like really expensive for me. And as I'm also a first gen college student, I haven't had any like financial support for college. So that wasn't an option for me. So instead I went to a different college local in Maryland, which is where I grew up, and I did comm and media studies, and I wanted to focus on photojournalism, but I actually wound up getting really interested in other classes I was taking, particularly, you know, like internet studies classes, or, you know, looking at research people are doing with how communities interact with and use technology. That kind of was the first time I'd encountered, I guess, HCI, human computer interaction, as kind of a field. So I guess by the end of my bachelor's, I also was doing an internship as kind of like a digital marketing intern at a startup company. So it was a small tech company, and I was exposed to kind of user experience design as a thing, which is not something I'd heard of. So kind of, I guess, a mixture of, you know, exposure in classes to some of the research and exposure in this little company to some of the industry practitioners who I started talking to about, you know, how did you find this path, led me to do a master's in HCI. And I thought I just wanted to be a practitioner and go be a UX designer when I did that. But I wound up really liking research more than the practitioner work, because I also did an internship just as a designer, and it was fine, but it wasn't necessarily what I wanted to do. But I got involved in research on actually blind and low vision communities and how they interact with technology. And we just happened to have a project that this PhD student at the time was doing on information about people and how computer vision could be a potential avenue for, you know, examining information about people for people who are blind. And so I guess I just got interested in computer vision for other marginalized communities. So I did my master's thesis on basically gender in computer vision. So I did an interview study with trans and non-binary people on how they felt about gender classification. And it just kind of became, I guess, my research area. So I've just continued from that point on.
Yeah, and I guess I'm wondering if we could even pause a little bit and define some of these terms that I've been mentioning so far, like machine learning, artificial intelligence, that are sort of key to what you're talking about with human-computer interaction. Could you define those for our listeners, just in case, you know, to clarify what we're talking about when we use those terms?
Yeah, I mean, to me, artificial intelligence is pretty much the same thing as machine learning. Machine learning is just like I guess, the more accurate way of defining artificial intelligence. And that is basically just feeding data to these predictive algorithms. So you're feeding prior data to the algorithm so that it can then make determinations or decisions or whatever it's designed to do on new data. That's kind of the general gist of machine learning. Computer vision is just a specific domain of machine learning. And it is kind of, in human terms, just how we would quote unquote teach a computer to see things. So it would analyze, instead of maybe textual information, visual information, which, you know, is converted to text or, you know, a binary for the computer. But from the perspective of the human, it's analyzing images to make determinations about future images.
So you've already started to nod to this, the way that where computing is going, where machine learning is going, is creating problems for historically marginalized identities, whether we're talking about ability or disability, whether we're talking about race, whether we're talking about gender. So can you speak a little bit to, because on one level, we're talking about technological developments that are allowing computers to do things that they never could before. And yet what we're also seeing, or what your research is finding and other researchers are finding, is that this is creating issues and problems that are exacerbating issues of oppression, discrimination in our society. So can you just walk us through a little bit of how that shows up, or just so we can be a little bit more aware of, or I guess attuned to, how this discrimination is playing out through machine learning and computing advances?
Yeah, so I would see potentially, I don't know if this is true, but off the top of my head, kind of a simplified way of viewing this is two ways that discrimination kind of happen or are exacerbated, like historical discrimination is exacerbated through using data that is historically biased. So for example, things like predicting loan worthiness using machine learning is often discriminatory because of racial histories of denying loans to people, and credit scores are very classist and racist, right? And often sexist. We've seen this with, I can't remember what company it was. I don't know if it was a credit card that kept denying women specifically. So this happens through using his bias data. So it can be explicit, as in there are variables for race and gender in the data. So maybe men and women are labeled in the data, and women have certain characteristics that are associated with that data that are undesirable for a loan. It could also be implicit, meaning there maybe isn't any racial or gender in the data, but there are markers associated kind of socially with gender and race that are still picked up by the system. And so that can be very difficult to audit as well, because how do you disentangle all of these factors? So that's kind of how I see historical marginalization being reintroduced. And then the second way is kind of just, it's more of a critical perspective, which is just reifying categories that already exist. And maybe we are having discussions about whether they should exist. And so things like gender and race are really interesting in that way, where, you know, we're re-embedding these concepts of what gender should look like in a system. And that is kind of recreating what gender already looks like over and over again. So I see that as kind of like two different ways that discrimination is happening.
Yeah, and thank you for providing that division, because that's so helpful to understand the way that, you know, in many ways, computing is dependent upon historical data in ways that, obviously, if we can point to sexist, racist, ableist, you know, legacies that were perhaps more explicit in the past, that those are going to show up in the data and influence computing today. And we also have issues of how that computing is being taught to understand what gender and race are, how those things are being defined, that in ways kind of limit the possibilities for being recognized, for showing up, for changing. I guess I'm curious if you personally have encountered this in your own life, in your own daily life, the way that, you know, what you're talking about, either with historical data or, you know, current computing definitions of, for example, gender or race, have impacted your life?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, because part of the issue, particularly with machine learning, is the opacity. So I know that we come into contact with this regularly. You know, anytime we get a shopping recommendation or a personalized ad online, that's probably using machine learning. Anytime we are applying for a loan or a credit card or housing, that's using some algorithmic system. It doesn't necessarily have to be machine learning, but I think a lot of, ideally for companies, a lot of things are moving in that direction, because then you don't have to manually kind of logic out the steps. You can just provide data and it can consistently kind of update what it's scoring. So we do come into contact with this regularly, but in terms of how, for example, for me, you know, my gender or gender history or race are coming into play, it's really hard to know those things, right? I will say that, like, doing studies on computer vision and gender, I've come into contact kind of unsurprisingly with a lot of misgendering from computers. Just auditing them, I'll often test my own image. There's apps that I know use certain computer vision services. So Amazon provides a service to a dating app that the CNN reporter I talked to had told me about. It's called Woo. It's actually an Indian dating app, so it's not something used in the US, but it uses gender verification when people sign up. And so I couldn't sign up as male because the perception of me was not male. So these things definitely happen, but in terms of actually being able to interact with a system that's doing gender classification, I haven't encountered that much in my regular life. But gender classification underlying other aspects like marketing or advertising, we all come into contact with that. It's just super opaque, right? Like, I get a lot of ads for like gay men, but I also get ads for women. So it's like a lot happening and it's constantly updating. I think it's Cheney Lippold who basically talks about things like online advertisements. Your social categories are constantly shifting, actually. So they're not static, which is really interesting to me, because it's almost progressive in the way that we think of things, like the way that we think of like gender theory or queer theory, as things shifting and allowing for change. But it's doing so in a way that's like not, like, it's not giving humans agency, right? So your gender is constantly shifting in online advertisement systems, but you're not really sure where it is or why it's doing that. And it's relying actually on a lot of stereotypes or what people think that your gender should be based on your behaviors. And so I find this concept of how machine learning allows things like gender to undulate, usually between binaries though, but it's also very restrictive.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Outsources on KGNU. I'm your host, Sean Kenny, and I'm talking with Morgan Klaus Scheuermann, a doctoral student at CU Boulder, whose research focuses on how machine learning specifically impacts historically marginalized populations. I think some listeners might be surprised hearing this and realizing that actually computers and computing digital technologies are increasingly determining people's gender, race, are recognizing people and categorizing them. Can you say just a little bit more about how this is showing up in our daily lives? Like, when are we being watched by these computers? When you mentioned advertising, which is a great example, right? So in maybe our browser history or things like that. But a lot of what you're talking about is facial recognition, right? And how that is being coded related to gender and race. So Could you give us a little more specifics about where this is showing up in our lives?
Yeah, in my work, I talk a lot about broadly what I would call facial analysis. So it might be facial recognition, but it might be these other kind of weird things that are separate. So facial recognition being like a one-to-one match. This is something that we're very familiar with. So we come into contact with this on our phones, right? Often things like Facebook use facial recognition in their tagging system. So it comes up there. Now coming through customs, like the TSA uses facial recognition and it's trying to match your passport photo to your current, you know, appearance. So we might come into contact with it there. And it is that facial recognition is also known to have gendered and racial issues in particular. So, you know, it's often biased towards in the US, there's this like inner race effect that happens depending on the context of which that technology was developed. So in the US, it's often biased towards white people. Basically, the diversity of data of white people that the system is trained to see is often much more diverse than other groups. And so therefore, it will mistake, it's more likely to have a very narrow range of what other groups look like. So it might not work super well. It might mistake you for a different person. It might not think you are the same person. So that happens with race. And then with gender, there are issues of, you know, if your presentation changes enough, it might be difficult to be verified. This is something that I know, you know, trans people deal with this with people all the time, especially in airports and things like that, and make decisions of like, well, how masculine or feminine am I going to present to deal with this situation, right? And if that doesn't necessarily align with your documentation, that can be an issue. So facial recognition tends to be biased towards kind of a normative appearance. Facial analysis systems are interesting because I think generally they're used in marketing the most, but they can be used in other areas. In there are instances, I know like the New York Times has done quite a lot of work on how China is using racial classification in AI systems to basically monitor minority groups. So those things can exist. They're just not as common as far as we know. So yeah, I'm trying to think of maybe other use cases where people might come into contact with these things regularly, but it's also difficult to know. That's always the hard part. Yeah.
Right. There's an additional level of kind of quote unquote company privacy or, you know, proprietary technology and how companies or even the government are using these things. And so an ability to really understand the extent of how they're being used can be difficult, which I would imagine would be scary for many people to kind of to hear that. And I guess it relates to another question I have, which is, for people who are concerned about this, about the increasing use of technologies that work really well, for example, if you're a cisgender white male, but further marginalize people, if, for example, you're trans, non-binary, if you're a person of color, if you have a disability, are there things that listeners or community members could do to address these types of issues? Like, are there things that you encourage people to do if they get upset after reading a paper of yours, or if they feel motivated to kind of act and do something about this issue?
Yeah, I think that's a good question. As far as I see, like, I mean, the most important thing would be to legislate companies and how they can use data and what they can use it for. So there are, you know, movements, and usually they're pretty localized. Like, I know New York has a lot. They have like the Stop Spying and like other movements around facial recognition specifically and trying to have that banned. And then, you know, you hear about legislation moving through specific cities on maybe the city banning its use in certain contexts. Often it's policing. So those are kind of avenues, I think, pushing maybe your representatives to care about these or bring them up, because it's just not super common, I think, for legislation to even be written about them. But I'm also, you know, not a policymaker. Like, that is not my area of expertise. So it's hard for me to recommend really specific actions for this. I will say that something I've noticed is mostly this is about facial recognition, and it's mostly policing. Sometimes it's also, you know, maybe public surveillance of streets and things like that. And that could be either commercial companies or police. But I've seen less concern around specific identity issues. And I think it would be worthwhile to maybe push, you know, policymakers, decision makers to think about these things. Especially because I am working right now, I am contracting with a company that does this. And there's no, I mean, it's really just like, what is the best practice and how can we convince stakeholders? There's not a lot of, there's no legal precedent or anything like that on what can be, how gender, for example, is used. So I really do think that policy is a major thing. I mean, many of the issues in tech are because tech is pretty much a self-regulating body at this point.
Yeah. And I guess you've had stints working in companies like Facebook, Google, you know, we've got this Microsoft fellowship. Do you have a sense from that side of things, like working in or with those companies, on how much of a priority this is for them? On, you know, is it going to take outside regulation, or is there, do you find hope in kind of what folks are doing in the companies themselves?
So I can say that the problem is that companies that large work, I mean, there's just so many teams doing so many different things. So, I mean, the teams that I have worked on do care, because that's the purpose of the team, is around, you know, ethics of AI or fairness in computer systems. There are like a million other teams that are product teams, or there are computer vision research teams that are specifically looking to improve the systems in certain ways that maybe I wouldn't agree with. And so there's kind of just this clash of values that also makes it very, very hard to, it makes it hard for one team to just change kind of the status quo of what is happening at the company. So, I mean, it's hard to say. I guess it's good that there are teams and people who are really advocating for change, but it is kind of, I think, an uphill battle for those people and those teams. I can say, so I was interning last year on the Google Ethical AI team, and you can see just looking at, I don't know if you know some of the controversy around what happened there, but there's a lot of coverage on two really high profile research managers on that team being ousted by Google. Basically, it was an instance of kind of retaliation for their work. And so it's a really risky space, I think, for people to really push ethics. Ethics has become a desirable thing for companies because it's something that the public cares about. But I think it's also kind of a marketing thing for a lot of companies. And so if you really push back, there's a huge risk to being fired or retaliated against. So it's a little bit grim, I guess, in that regard. But I do think that industry researchers have a lot of power over, say, academic researchers on changing existing products.
I guess as we start to wrap up our conversation, I'm just curious, like, what's the future you would ideally like to see, like 10, 20, even 50 years down the line with some of the things you're researching? I think it can be easy to look at some of this stuff and think like, we need to move away from this. Others are like, you know, this is the inevitable. It's our brave new world we're living into. Get used to it. I mean, what does that future ideally look like for you? Are there certain technologies that don't exist or that are different? If you were to kind of play a little bit in that imagination space.
Yeah. I mean, one thing, maybe this doesn't even feel like a 10-year thing. I feel like it should be an earlier thing to me, is just really specific constrained uses of computer vision is ideal to me. Like, I think that we should be assessing the legality and the ethics of computer vision within the context of very specific use cases, instead of these general all-purpose models that we can use for everything. That I don't think that is the future, because it's leading to all of these issues of like you know, context shifting is also an issue where bias can be introduced into a new context because it wasn't built for that context. So for me, a lot of things like gender recognition and other identity recognition technologies, I don't see many good commercial use cases or government or any of police use cases for that. So I guess our future would be just that doesn't exist. It's not allowed to exist. But there are like fun, I think, interesting, you know, ways computer vision could probably be empowering for people. Just like I've seen like people play with like drag and computer vision and things like that, like just filters for computer vision. That could also be an interesting potential exploration of how to push back. So like CV dazzle is kind of a thing, which is like trying to trick a computer system by wearing makeup in a really ridiculous or opaque way that makes it hard to tell that a person is there. So that's super fun. Yeah, I guess I haven't thought as much about the positive futures for this technology, but I'm sure that there are things there. Yeah, I'm sure that there are a lot of cool artistic things people could use it for as well.
You've been listening to Outsources on KGNU Boulder, Denver, Fort Collins. I'm Sean Kenny, and I've been speaking with doctoral student and researcher Morgan Klaus-Scheuermann. This past year, Morgan was one of 10 students selected nationally for a Microsoft PhD research fellowship for his research on machine learning, identity, and discrimination. Morgan, thank you so much for joining me on Outsources today.
Yeah, thanks for having me. This was great.
For more information on Morgan and his work, go online to our website at news.kgnu.org and click on Outsources under the Shows and Features tab. Once there, you can listen to the recording of this and other Outsources shows. As always, let us know if you have comments or feedback about tonight's show by emailing outsources@kgnu.org.